Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, recounts, tweet wars, and charges of voter fraud. Welcome to the presidential transition.
Some people who had looked at the numbers in Wisconsin and Pennsylvania and Michigan and thought they saw irregularities or irregular patterns on the balloting, but there's no real evidence for that.
Also today, Imam Teimoullah Abdar-Rahman, from selling drugs in Roxbury to tangling with the law. Harvard University's Muslim chaplain talks about his journey to Islam and what it means to be a Muslim in the time of Trump. Plus, Pulitzer Prize winner Michael Chabon on his new novel, Moonlight, a faux memoir that blurs the line between fact and fiction.
You're telling a lie when you're writing a novel. It's the only good kind of lie. It's the lie that you're telling to someone with their permission. And not only with their permission, but at their invitation.
All that coming up this hour on Radio Boston. First, this news.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. So, the man who said the election was rigged won, but Donald Trump lost the popular vote by more than 2 million votes and counting, and he says that's because millions of people voted illegally. But he's presented no evidence of that. Meanwhile, the campaign of Hillary Clinton, which conceded to Trump, has now joined a recount effort in three states initiated by Green Party candidate Jill Stein, though there's no evidence of any voter irregularity in those states. So welcome to the presidential transition. To help us make sense of what's going on and with some of the latest news, we're joined by Matt Visor, Deputy Washington Bureau Chief of the Boston Globe. He joins us from Washington. Hi, Matt. Good to have you.
Hey, Anthony. Thanks for having me.
So let me sort of pick up where that introduction left off. Yesterday, Trump responded on Twitter to Jill Stein's push for a recount in three states, Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania, by saying that he lost the popular vote because of voter fraud in three other states, New Hampshire, Virginia, and California. What is he actually claiming here? And is there any basis for these claims?
There is no basis for the claims, but what he is claiming is that there were 3 million illegal immigrants, undocumented immigrants who voted in the election. And had they not voted or those votes had not counted, he believes he would have won. This appears to be coming out of sort of a blogosphere and sort of conservative media that don't have basis in fact for these claims. But that is where Trump is at least appears to be getting the information that he's trying to use to claim that he won both the popular vote and the Electoral College vote.
Matt, it seems like he's reviving claims that he made throughout the campaign that the system is rigged, but he won the election. So isn't he in a way lending credence to the recount effort put in motion by Jill Stein? I mean, why do this now, given that he won?
I mean, it continues sort of the baffling strategies of Donald Trump, where, you know, he does appear like a sore loser here when he actually won. You know, I mean, he won the election. There's not any dispute at this point over the Electoral College vote, and yet he is perpetuating these claims of a rigged election, but at the same time opposing moves to do recounts in some of these states. So it cognitively does not make much sense. It gets back to a little bit of Donald Trump's reactions to people when he feels like he's been affronted, which he feels like in this case he is, so he's firing back, but without making factual claims and sort of, you know, there's a question of what's the point, you know, at this stage. He should probably be focused more on establishing his cabinet and looking forward to January and taking over as president.
And I want to talk to you a little bit about that, but let me ask you a question or two about the recount effort pushed by Jill Stein, joined by the Hillary Clinton campaign. It could include three states, Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania, all states that Clinton expected to win, but that Trump won narrowly. What's the latest there?
So Michigan has just been called and certified for Donald Trump. That is the latest state, you know, probably the last state to be sort of finalized for Trump. It was too close to call earlier. There are efforts largely pushed through Jill Stein, the Green Party nominee, although Hillary Clinton's campaign has joined some of those efforts, largely in Wisconsin, to challenge some of those results and to establish a recount that will be happening in Wisconsin. Jill Stein is also moving to do the same in Pennsylvania, targeting some of those counties as well. There does not seem to be any indication that the results overall would change. All three of these states would have to have something dramatic happen through the recount, some big finding that nobody is suggesting is there at this stage in order for Hillary Clinton to, you know, become the president-elect. So that does not appear to be happening. But at the same time, there are challenges. There will be recounts in at least some of these cases.
So the votes were close in all three of those states, but they don't appear to be close enough to overturn the recount. So we asked, you know, why Donald Trump was making allegations of voter fraud in an election he won. Hillary Clinton has conceded this election. What's in it for her for joining this recount effort? I mean, is this sort of like a Hail Mary last sort of gasp of effort here or what?
It is a little bit striking her joining these efforts. There is still some angst on the left, sort of a disbelief that Donald Trump was elected, that their candidate Hillary Clinton lost. And Hillary Clinton, I think, you know, part of it is trying to they may drive up some of the popular vote that she's winning by, but even her campaign lawyer Mark Elias, who is the one sort of active, at least in participating with Jill Stein, is downplaying any suggestion that she would be president. They're sort of in favor of making sure that the votes were counted properly, but they are saying that it won't change the ultimate outcome. So they still feel like there's a case to be made to counting the votes and making sure that they're done properly, even while not sort of changing the ultimate outcome of the election.
Now, Matt, as you suggested, all this happens as Donald Trump, we think, appears to be focusing on filling out his cabinet. And let me ask you about one possibility that seems particularly controversial: former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney for Secretary of State. They met last week. Even though Romney was among the first of those establishment Republicans to really repudiate Trump in a very harsh speech last March. But here's Trump spokeswoman Kellyanne Conway speaking to CNN over the weekend about resistance to Romney among many Trump loyalists. Here she is.
The backlash from the grassroots. I'm hearing from people who say, hey, my aunt, my parents died penniless, but I gave $216 to Donald Trump's campaign and I would feel betrayed. You have people saying, I thought we got rid of this type. We don't even know if Mitt Romney voted for Donald Trump.
So, Matt, what's going on here? Does it look like Mitt Romney is out, or what? How's this internal struggle taking shape within President-elect Trump's administration?
Yeah, like so many things about Donald Trump, it's hard to tell how much of this is real and how much of it is sort of for show. You know, how much of Kellyanne Conway's comments are orchestrated and how much is she sort of trying to influence the man that she works for from the outside, by sort of stirring up opposition to someone who she doesn't want to get the pick for Secretary of State. I think there is legitimate concern that Kellyanne Conway addresses with Mitt Romney as Secretary of State. It's hard to overstate the amount of animosity between Romney and Trump during the campaign. As you pointed out, Romney was one of the most outspoken of anybody about Donald Trump. So it is striking the fact that these two men are even having conversations about this. By all accounts, they met for 90 minutes last week in a very positive conversation that they both sort of left feeling good about one another. They're going to meet again tomorrow So it does appear that Mitt Romney is still in the mix for Secretary of State, although the search is broadening at the same time. Donald Trump just now is meeting with David Petraeus as well, who's believed to be another candidate for Secretary of State. So there's a lot of intrigue and a lot of action sort of right now at Trump Tower for Trump to figure out who he's going to pick. And Mitt Romney still appears to be in the mix, although the opposition toward him is also fierce.
Now, I want to ask you, as someone who's written about Mitt Romney, the former governor here, I mean, as we both made reference to, he called Donald Trump back in March a fraud and a phony. I mean, what's your sort of analysis on why Mitt Romney would pursue this? I mean, obviously, being Secretary of State is a great honor, but given what he said about the president-elect, it makes one you wonder a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, how does Mitt Romney, in other words, justify to himself that it's worth serving a man who he has said and by all accounts believes is a fraud?
Exactly.
And a phony, you know, and I think for Mitt Romney, he would justify it in a way that, you know, he feels like he can impact change from within more than he could from the outside. And maybe he believes that as Secretary of State, which is a very powerful position within the administration, he could impact things from within the administration. At the same time, you know, he would be potentially waking up in the morning responding to tweets of the President Trump, you know, and having to kind of disagree with the president. Mitt Romney's father, interestingly, for historical perspective, also served in the cabinet of Richard Nixon. And his father was sort of on the outs within that cabinet and eventually got so frustrated that he resigned. So, you know, Mitt Romney, you know, no doubt that's in his mind as well, of sort of serving somebody who you don't exactly agree with, but trying to make change from within that administration.
Matt, I want to ask you finally about this great piece you wrote in the Sunday Boston Globe about Steve Bannon, who Donald Trump appointed as chief White House counselor. Bannon ran Breitbart, the online news agency that has promoted nationalist and racist views. And you went back and looked at Bannon's years when he was a student at the Harvard Business School. What surprised you about interviewing those folks who knew a younger Steve Bannon?
Well, one of the things that was surprising to me was how many classmates don't recognize the Steve Bannon that they read about today. You know, that they knew a guy, you know, who was bright and, you know, did not espouse anti-Semitic views, racist views. You know, he was a different type of character at that period of his life. Some of them justify the things that they read now and the things that they see on Breitbart, that, you know, Steve Bannon, they don't think believes those kind of things, but he has identified a marketplace, you know, in essence using those skills that he brought out of Harvard Business School to find areas in our society that do have those viewpoints that Steve Bannon is marketing toward that segment of our society, which is not exactly a rosy view of the situation, but it's one that, you know, it, to them feels more in line with the Steve Bannon that they knew, you know, who was not the same kind of anti-Semitic, a racist kind of guy that he's often portrayed as, at least in the news media.
Well, Matt, it was a fascinating piece. Thanks for bringing it to us. And listeners, by the way, you can find a link to Matt's piece on Steve Bannon at radioboston.org. And Matt Beiser, Deputy Washington Bureau Chief for the Boston Globe, thanks so much for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
And listeners, stay with us. Coming up, Harvard's Muslim chaplain Imam Taymullah Abdar Rahman talks about growing up in Roxbury, performing in a successful R&B group, and his conversion to Islam. Stay with us. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. During his presidential campaign, Donald Trump called for a full or partial ban on Muslim immigration. He talked about a national registry for Muslim immigrants. Now, whether any of that will come to pass or even pass constitutional muster, we don't know. But we do know this about the incoming president. He named Lieutenant General Michael Flynn as his national security advisor. The retired general has said Islam is a political ideology hiding behind a religion, and that fear of Muslims is rational. So these are interesting and possibly challenging times for Muslim leaders in our society. So today, we thought we'd hear from one of them. Imam Taymullah Abdur-Rahman grew up in Roxbury, performed in a successful R&B group, had several run-ins with the law, and converted to Islam. He's now an imam and chaplain at Harvard University and joins us in our studios. And Imam, welcome to Radio Boston. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks, Anthony. Thanks for having me.
Let me back up and just talk about this election. Okay. Many Muslims have said they are feeling fearful after the election of Donald Trump. I'm wondering, how are you feeling?
Well, I think I'm feeding off the energy of the constituency I serve, right? A lot of the students at Harvard University are full of angst, anxiety, fear, resentment. A lot of them are not able to work. You know, they have to get extensions on lessons and studying. So I think that there's a lot to be concerned about, and we have to be careful not to be reactionary, but we also have to be very critical going forward.
Now, I'd like to hear about these students. Who are they? Are they generally, are they American Muslims or foreign Muslims? Who's coming to you with concerns?
Right. So they're American-born Muslims who have parents who immigrated here 30 years ago or so. But I think, Anthony, it's important to also note that, you know, the Arbilis, a Syrian family, came here, you know, in 1878. A professor and his six sons, they started a Star of America newspaper. And the people who built the railroads here in the 1920s were Yemeni Arab Muslims. You know, so we have a history here as Muslims in this environment. I mean, I don't think it's anything new to say that, you know, we've just gotten here in the 70s and 80s. We've been here. And a lot of these students are feeling as though, hey, I'm an American. When something happens, I feel like a victim as well when there's a terrorist attack. But then there's also the dual narrative of them feeling as though they have to deflect suspicion and the umbrella of, you know, accusations that come along with those attacks.
Terrible pressure to be taking on. So what do you tell them when they bring these concerns to you and about having to bear the burden of such suspicions?
Well, I think, first of all, as a person of faith and as a counselor, a chaplain, my job is to help them see the larger picture, right? To see that, you know, as Paul Harvey said, in times like these, there's always been times like these. And that it's our job to remain faithful and to remain committed to the process. And I think that, you know, in college life, activism plays a huge part. So we're committed to voting local. We're committed to activism. We're committed to critiquing the administration and everything it needs to be critiqued for and supporting what's good.
Yeah. I would love to get a little bit about your story because you're very much of this city. You grew up in Roxbury. Tell me about your family, what life was like for you growing up in Boston.
Well, I come from a single family, a single parent household. My mom was a breadwinner, a nurturer, a person who loved us all, gave us all the hugs and kisses we needed. Myself, my five siblings. And basically, I grew up in the 80s during Reaganomics. Things were tough. A lot of violence, a lot of drugs. So we had to find a way to navigate that and still try to find a way to make a living for ourselves and do better.
Yeah. And so you ended up on the wrong side of the law, I guess I could say, for a while, right?
Yeah. I mean, you know, I got into the singing group Perfect Gentlemen in 89, and I did that for a few years. But what I found was that, you know, I was a teenager, 16, 17 years old. That lifestyle in Roxbury in the streets was calling me.
Yeah.
So I left the group in 92, went back to the streets, became a teen father, sold drugs, got into some violent confrontations. And I lived that way off and on for maybe almost a decade before I had a change of heart.
And what, you know, this is such an interesting question that I've asked a lot of folks. What caused that change of heart? Because, of course, there are young people who are drawn to that life all the time, often for very understandable reasons, but there's often something that gets them out of that life.
Indeed.
What was it for you?
For me, I think it was several things. I think, number one, I always had a supportive household. My mom always supported me. My siblings, my one brother and four sisters were a support system for me. Whenever I would fall, they were there to pick me up and encourage me. And I think if you don't have a purpose-driven life, like many youth, urban youth don't, then you're more susceptible to be at risk. So for me, that was a mitigating factor. In addition to that, I had a newborn son, right? And I knew that if he was going to be better than me, then I had to do better for myself. And those two things proved to be the catalyst for me to try to change my life.
Yeah. You know, I hope you don't mind. I want to play some music because you mentioned for a period you were part of a band called Perfect Gentlemen, right?
Indeed.
So this is a track from Perfect Gentlemen. This is called Ooh La La, I Can't Get Over You.
Right.
So this is your piece. So we're just going to listen for a little bit here.
Okay.
So, Timu, I just have to. So there you are in the Perfect Gentlemen. But I'm just wondering, you know, going from the notoriety of being in a singing group like that back to Roxbury, that must have created some challenges, right?
Yeah, I was traumatized, to say the least.
Yeah.
You know, we were on Oprah Winfrey on the cover of Golden Graham cereal, and then you're thrust back on the block, so to speak.
Right.
And so there was a lot of times I had to prove my manhood, quote unquote, because if you don't, then you become a victim easily in that environment.
Yeah. So I want to learn more about your conversion to Islam. Tell me a little bit about that route.
Well, I had a teacher in the sixth grade. Her name was Zuhaira Bilal, and she kind of planted the seed. She used to talk to us about life and about, you know, nature, and she used to take us when she donated blood, and we used to be fascinated by her lifestyle. She planted the seed. You know, I got distracted for the next 10 years or so, but a guy I was running with, his name was Apple. We thought his name was Apple, and we were on our way to do a home invasion, and we sat outside for an hour. We couldn't figure out which house it was, and it was a specific guy we were looking for, and we didn't know which house it was. And so after an hour, I decided I'm going home. I'm tired. So I went home. Apple ended up that night going to a house party in Brookline, Massachusetts, where he got into a shootout there in the party in Brookline.
Mm.
And so he ended up going to jail, doing 13 years. And it was during that time that he rediscovered his Islamic identity. He was born Muslim. And so then he began to write me and tell me about, you know, the benefits of Islam and the benefits I could edify myself with spiritually. I wasn't listening for the first maybe 5 years. And then after some time, I started going through my own struggles with my son and just in life in general as I matured. And so I ended up, you know, giving him an ear, which led to me converting in 1999.
Wow. And now 1999, of course, before the terrorist attack of 9/11, what was that like for you after those attacks?
Well, I guess after the attacks, it was sort of like it feels right now, right? A lot of despair, a lot of not knowing what the future holds, but also knowing that there's a place for American Muslims here and that, you know, we've been victimized as well. Whenever these people commit these acts, you know, they're committing them against all of us. And so there's a desire to create a platform where we can speak out and build alliance and coalition with those who are like-minded.
Yeah. I want to ask you about the move over to Harvard, where you serve as the Muslim chaplain at Harvard. I mean, of course, from Roxbury to Harvard Square, it's just a few miles, but some might say it's also a world away those two worlds are separated by a great distance. How do you feel about that? How do you close that distance, I guess, between the world that you grew up in and where you're serving now?
That's important. I think that's a great question. I think because a lot of times Harvard University is known for venerating awareness on par with action, right? So if we know something and we're educated about it, sometimes we feel as though we've done all we can do. But I think it's my job, having that experience with real poverty, with real violence, and real, you know, some civil liberties being violated, to bring that experience on campus. And sometimes I do it and I speak about things that make people uncomfortable. Faculty, you know, students, people who come from local communities for the Friday sermon. And I do that on purpose to try to bring that brutal reality in their face.
Yeah. And how do they respond?
Mostly positive, right? Because
mostly.
But, you know, sometimes there's some pushback along the lines of, you know, we're doing what we can. And that's important to acknowledge that, you know, a lot of times people are trying the best with the tools that they have. But, you know, knowing something and acting on it, two different things.
Well, Imam Taymullah Abdar Rahman is a chaplain, a Muslim chaplain at Harvard University. Tay, thanks so much for joining us today. We really, really appreciate it. I look forward to talking to you more about these issues in the weeks and months and years ahead.
Thank you, Anthony.
Good to meet you. Stay with us. Coming up, writer Michael Chabon about his new book, Moonglow. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. Cuba is in a period of official mourning following the death of Fidel Castro, a man who some, including many Cubans, see as a liberator of historical proportions. Others, including many in the large expat community, are celebrating Castro's death as the end of a ruthless autocrat who jailed tens of thousands of dissidents, killing and torturing many of them, and repressed Cuba by banning free speech, freedom of assembly, and a free press. WBUR's Simone Rios spoke to prominent Cubans in the Boston area and found that many are neither celebrating nor mourning the death of Fidel Castro.
My name is Arturo Sandoval, and I was born in Artemisa, which is a little village of the countryside of Cuba.
Arturo Sandoval is a protege of the great trumpeter Dizzy Gillespie and one of the most prominent defectors from Fidel Castro's Cuba. He was in town this weekend at Scholars Jazz Club, and he was in the middle of a set when Raul Castro announced his brother Fidel had died.
I didn't find out until almost midnight when I get to the room and I turn on my phone. I got so many messages from friends and relatives. It's a mixed feeling because I think nobody should get happy or celebrate the death of any human. But in this case, it means a lot more than a person who died. It's a philosophy.
Like many Cuban exiles living in the United States, Sandoval's story is deeply personal. In 1990, he escaped Cuba while touring Europe. His next order of business was to send for his parents.
They got their passport in order, everything was ready. I sent the plane tickets, everything was good to go. And the day before, they called them to immigration office there. And they took the passports and the plane tickets and they turned down and dropped it in the garbage can right in front of them. And they told them, forget about it. I got order from Fidel Castro in person to tell you that you're never going to be able to leave the country. Forget about to see your son.
Both in their 70s, Sandoval's parents jumped onto a raft with 10 other people bound for Florida. He says they were among the oldest people he knows of ever to make the trip by raft. Sandoval's story is not unusual among Cuban Americans, but among some Boston area Cubans, the stories of suffering under Fidel Castro are more distant. Isaac Bornstein left Cuba as a boy in 1960. The year after Castro swept into Havana with his rebel army. 56 years later, and the supreme commander is dead.
I feel sad. I feel like for those of us who are old enough to both have understood the importance of history and live through history, see one of the real important figures of history lose his life. Somebody who, for me, the biggest sadness is, who's going to speak for the poor in the developing world?
Borenstein spent 16 years on the bench as a superior court judge in Massachusetts and now teaches at Suffolk Law School. He leads a trip of students to a law school in Cuba where they study things like inheritance law in a socialist legal system. He says he'd like to see Cuba preserve the benefits of the Castro Revolution, such as the elimination of illiteracy and health care for all Cubans, while opening the doors to democracy and a mixed economy.
Let's make sure we guarantee people the basic way of life economically. And let's also have more openness, access to the internet, newspaper, publications, maybe more democratic electoral processes.
The death of Fidel Castro resonates far beyond the borders of Cuba.
If we were meeting not in Boston, Massachusetts, but in Johannesburg, South Africa, many would remember him as the only political leader willing to deploy troops to stop a South African apartheid regime invasion of Angola.
Jorge Dominguez teaches Latin American studies at Harvard. He also left Cuba as a child.
If we were speaking not in Massachusetts but in Haiti, there are a great many people in Haiti of all sorts, but certainly many poor people, who have been attended to by Cuban healthcare personnel.
Dominguez says Castro's good works deserve praise, but he's not blind to the charges against the former Cuban leader, that he was a dictator who jailed thousands of political prisoners. What Dominguez is certain about is the world has lost a highly complex figure, the likes of which history does not often see.
Ultimately, probably what I miss the most about him is all of the intrinsic complexity. Most political figures are not that complex, are just not that interesting. And he was.
Fidel Castro prophesied early in his career that history would absolve him. Cuban immigrant Miren Uriarte agrees.
I think it will. Given the importance in today's world of inequality between the poor and the rich, Cuba hit that straight on. And I think that's what he will be remembered for.
Uriarte is a Boston School Committee member and professor emeritus of sociology at UMass Boston. She came to the U.S. from Cuba as a young girl and has spent decades trying to help normalize relations between the U.S. and Cuba. Uriarte says she understands why people hurt by the revolution despise Castro, but she can also see why others revere him.
This is not about black and white. Revolutions are not about black and white. There's all kinds of tones of gray.
Asked whether she considers herself pro-Fidel, Uriarte laughs and says she's pro-Cuba.
That was WBUR's Simone Rios reporting on reaction to the death of Cuban leader Fidel Castro. This is Moonglow, played by the Benny Goodman Quartet. Moonglow is also the title of Pulitzer Prize-winning writer Michael Chabon's new novel. Moonglow is framed as a memoir in which the narrator, a guy named Michael Chabon, recounts the life of his grandparents who came of age in the period of this music. Much of the narrative is a kind of deathbed confession from the grandfather, who tells Chabon stories about World War II combat, Jewish life in post-war America, mental illness, the Holocaust, and the early development of rockets. Now, in his note to readers, Chabon says this: "In preparing this memoir, I have stuck to facts, except when facts refuse to conform with memory, narrative, purpose, or the truth as I prefer to understand it." Michael Chabon is the author of several books, including The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay, for which he won the Pulitzer Prize in Fiction. He'll be at the Brookline Booksmith event at the Coolidge Corner Theater tonight, and he joins us now. And Michael Chabon, great to have you. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you, Anthony. It's very good to be here.
Yeah, it's great, and I'm just loving this book. I'm about 100 pages into it, which is no small feat because I'm way too busy to read big, thick books, but this is so good that
it's
grabbed
you.
Me.
Thank you. I really appreciate that.
And listeners, we want to invite you into this conversation. Have you read Michael Chabon's other novels? Have you read this latest one, Moonglow? What do you think about a book of fiction disguised as a memoir? What questions do you have for Michael Chabon? You can give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. So I want to ask you about that wonderful sort of disclaimer at the beginning, saying that, you know, you're adhering to facts for as long as facts are basically convenient to be adhered to.
Right. I'm saying I'm not adhering to them at all, is what I'm really saying. Yeah.
But it sounds like a statement really in defense of fiction, the novel, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think I've come of age as a novelist in the era of the creative nonfiction renaissance, or and the ascendancy of the literary memoir, and I've had to, in a sense, stand by and watch as these documents, many of them, I hasten to say, are some of my favorite books and some of the most beautiful books of the past quarter century or so. So, like This Boy's Life by Tobias Wolff, or I think when the granddaddy of the genre is Stop Time by Frank Conroy is such a beautiful book. I'm not really knocking memoirists per se, but this idea that what you get in between the covers of a memoir is the truth is factual is highly dubious statement. And so, you know, I think I wanted to try to somehow find a way in telling this story, among all the other things I was trying to do, to sort of assert the power of fiction to tell a truth that you could never get at through any other means, that the only way to arrive at it is by making up a lie, is telling a lie.
Right.
So,
and now this idea of making up a lie or telling a series of lies, I mean, it's sort of, you're sort of entering into a kind of contract with the reader, right?
Absolutely.
I mean, we
that's
sort
really
of know
important.
That. Yeah.
It's very important. And so to me, what makes the lies of the novelist not just permissible, but potentially, you know, beautiful or admirable, is the fact that the reader knows perfectly well from the beginning that this is a lie. The reader gives her consent to be lied to and says, please lie to me. I've come to you to be lied to. Just make it a good one, please.
Yeah.
And that's really important. I mean, that's how it works with, you know, stage magic, right? That's a comparison I've drawn frequently where, you know, you know, the magician says, like, you know, I'm not actually going to be sawing.
Right. This is sleight of hand.
You know, yeah. Right. And you can sit there and try to figure out how I'm doing it if you want to, or you could just sit back and enjoy the illusion or whatever. But it's there is that contract. There's that implicit contract. And to me, that is missing sometimes with memoirs, where the reader, I feel often, and I speak as a reader of memoirs, is often really not certain where how to evaluate this, or to put all of one's faith in the teller and say, look, okay, obviously you're just going to be telling me everything that ever really happened in this case, or how much invention is taking place. It's much less clear. That makes me nervous. That makes me uncomfortable.
But aren't they both? I mean, whether it's memoir or in your case, faux memoir, whether you're dealing with sort of a statement that this is a series of lies and I'm not going to pretend otherwise, mm-hmm. to this is the best sort of recollection I have as mm-hmm. to what happened. Aren't they both sort of serving a bigger truth?
I don't know exactly. I don't know the answer to that. And there are memoirs and there are memoirs.
Yeah.
And some memoirs, I think some of the ones that might be considered the greatest, find ways to signal either openly or in implicit ways when characters, personages are being conflated, or maybe they've left someone out. They might be an afterword or acknowledgement or something that lets you know. Obviously, no one has the kind of perfect recall for conversations that took place decades ago that you often encounter.
Right.
How much readers actually, the average reader, if there is such a thing, who picks up a memoir and is reading a report in this memoir of what someone said to someone, you know, 40 years ago, how much the average reader is going to be thinking, oh, I'm sure the writer's making this all up because nobody could remember that, and how much the reader is thinking, you know, writers are magical people. Maybe if you're a writer, you actually can remember things that happened 40 years ago verbatim.
Right. I don't actually know.
Special
brains that retain these amazing facts.
I mean, I think that's what I thought when I was a kid.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. Listeners, if you're just joining us, Michael Chabon is the author of Moonglow, a novel. It's sort of a faux memoir. It's sort of framed as a memoir, but it's a novel. And I want you to tell me, Michael, a little bit about the character of your grandfather. Now, I say your grandfather mm-hmm. because the narrator is a guy named Michael Chabon, mm-hmm. so there's going to be a lot of... Anyway, tell me about the grandfather.
The grandfather.
That's what I meant to ask.
The grandfather in this novel is a... in a way, he's a kind of paradigm of the tough Jew, of the silent, taciturn, emotionally not particularly connected male of his generation. You know, I had relatives like that growing up. Not my grandfather. I mean, my grandfather came out of a very different kind of approach to being a man. Not that he was very touchy-feely. He wasn't the most... he wasn't especially connected to his emotions, I would say, either, but he was very verbal and he loved to talk. He loved wordplay and joking around. And this is this sort of strong, silent type. But this man is, you know, I'll be honest with you. Putting together this character out of materials from people I remember from my childhood, from relatives, from various kinds of men I've known over the course of my life, especially from this generation born in the grandfather here is born in 1917. In many ways, it's more than anything else, this is kind of a self-portrait. In that, in a way, this is sort of a what if, and the what if of this novel is, what if I didn't, for whatever reason, struggle as hard as I struggle not to be taciturn, misanthropic, antisocial, have a kind of disdainful attitude toward all humanity, including oneself. I have all those tendencies in me, and for various reasons, it's become important to me over the course of my life to sort of fight against those tendencies. Mm. And not only that, this grandfather is a very violent man. He gets very angry, and sometimes he gets uncontrollably angry.
Yeah, there's a scene very early on in the movie where he essentially, I mean, this lands him in jail, right? He mm-hmm. almost strangles someone.
In prison,
yeah, mm-hmm. because he gets so mad at losing his job that he strangles someone with a piano?
It's a telephone cord.
A telephone cord, that's
yeah.
it, yeah.
Yes, his boss.
So big
yeah.
man, big appetites, big reactions, big emotions.
Mm-hmm. But very tightly wrapped so yeah. that when they come out in a very kind of an uncontrollable way. Uncontrollable burn, you know, like an oil well that's been set on fire. And once it's set on fire, it's hard to put it out.
And he's a great storyteller. One of the first stories you learn about him early on is he explains to his grandson, Michael Chabon, that his first sexual experience was with a bearded woman. It's a good detail.
Yeah. yeah. As far as I know, that is not the case with my actual grandfather, though we didn't really ever talk about it. So it could have been. But yeah, he... I mean, the thing is, actually, he never has been much of a storyteller. And I think at one point the narrator says something like, 90% of everything I ever learned about my grandfather, I learned in the last 10 days of his life.
Yeah.
And it's only once the grandfather is dying, and he's basically in the palliative care phase of terminal cancer, and he's on heavy painkillers, he's on Dilaudid, that this sort of loosens his tongue and jars his memory, and he finally begins to talk. And that actually does have some basis in my real life experience, in that my grandfather, although he was talkative and he did tell stories and he wasn't closed up the way this man is, still, when he was dying at my mother's house and he was in the same terminal phase of cancer and on heavy painkillers, he talked a lot, and he told me stories, but the things that he was telling me were things I had never heard before.
Oh, interesting.
And that is what...
Did you realize then that, hey, this is material for a book?
I mean, no, I did not, but what I did, I think, start to understand then, and it's a painful understanding, and it's one that has, you know, continued, and in some ways the pain of it has only intensified over the years, is that I was with this man for... I was 25 when he died. So for 25 years of my life, I had the chance to talk to this guy, you know, and realize that he was a human being, and not that some with your grandparents, if we have a tendency to sometimes idealize our parents, it's even more with our grandparents. And when I say idealize, I don't necessarily mean we look highly on them. We can also sort of negatively idealize our grandparents too. They become demonized or they become glorified. You think like grandpa's, you know, the guy that wears...
But we don't make that effort to really excavate and deep into their soul
figure
out
can't.
Who they are.
We're not ready to. And I think one of the tragedies of life is that when you hit the age where you actually turn backward and you say, you know, who are those people or who were those people?
Yeah.
It's too late usually. They're either gone already or they go quickly thereafter.
Well, the grandfather in Moonglow says to his grandson, Michael Chabon, after I'm gone, write it down. Explain everything. Make it mean something. Use a lot of those fancy metaphors of yours. Put the whole thing in proper chronological order, not like this mishmash I'm making it you. So, you know, what's interesting about that is your narrator doesn't put it in chronological mm-hmm. order, but he does paint a pretty vivid picture of this guy and of this amazing time in America. Mm-hmm. So does he carry out his grandfather's wish?
Well, in a way, but the thing about this guy, this grandfather, and it's in a way this is when it becomes most clear, yeah. is he's taunting his grandson with that. He's saying, I know you. You have these romantic notions. You have these, you know, it actually comes in the context of his saying, I'm ashamed of myself. I'm ashamed of my life. And when I look back on what I've done, I wish I hadn't. And so he's really baiting his grandson in a way, saying you're going to make something out of this that is so much more impressive than how I feel about my life. He's kind of a nihilistic dude, the grandfather, and so in a way, if in writing this novel and telling this story, my narrator is in a sense he's actually going against his grandfather's wishes in a certain way. If he were to really follow his grandfather's wishes, he would have left everything completely forgotten and unremarked upon, because I think that's how the grandfather would have preferred it all to be.
Interesting. Now, I want to ask you about the grandmother. Tell me about her, but tell me about this character. What makes her tick, who she is? What's the sort of short profile?
Well, what makes her tick is sort of the ultimate mystery of the whole book. Right. And she is a very enigmatic figure in the life of her husband, in the life of her daughter, and in the life of her grandson as well. She was born in France. She emigrated to the United States after the war. Her story is clearly caught up with the Holocaust, with the German occupation of France, with the deportation of French Jews. But how her story is caught up with that, and in what manner she came through that experience, and what she did it or did not do to survive, is a source of profound mystery throughout the entire length of the book. And even in one's daily experience of this woman, and we get some scenes from the point of view of the grandson when he's a little boy and he's just trying to sort of sort out the adult world the way a 4 or 5 year old might start to try to do. And this woman, his grandmother, causes him problems from the beginning, because sometimes she's vibrant and big and funny and energetic, and she carries out these sort of imaginary games with him, and she takes him places, and she loves him intensely. And then the next time he sees her, she's all she wants to do is lie in bed, and she can't come out of her room, and she has nothing for him, and she's clearly depressed. And he's to try to get a sense of someone who's never quite the same person twice is the challenge for the narrator.
Right. And so toward the end of the novel, the narrator makes a really shocking discovery about his grandmother, and it leads the reader and the narrator to question the truth of the whole sort of story, which already we know is a fiction, but it's an interesting moment. I wonder if you could read a section of that part. It's right in the middle there on page 356.
Sure, yes. The narrator has, long after his grandfather's death, even longer after his grandmother's death, he's gone to, he's decided, he's thinking maybe of writing a novel somehow based on his grandmother's life, and so he actually starts digging around and doing some research, and he tracks down some key information about her that is, as you say, it comes as a real shock. one by one, I began to subject my memories of my grandmother, of the things she had told me and the way she had behaved, to a formal review, a kind of failure analysis, searching and testing them for their content of deceit, for the hidden presence in them of the truth. I kept what I had learned from my wife until I returned from Mantaloking. I kept it from my mother and the rest of the world until I began to research and write this memoir, abandoning, repudiating a novelistic approach to the material. Sometimes even lovers of fiction can be satisfied only by the truth. I felt like I needed to get my story straight, so to speak, in my mind and in my heart. I needed to work out, if I could, the relationship between the things I had heard and learned about my family and its history while growing up and the things I now knew to be true.
And we're not going to give away what the great reveal is, but I love that paragraph because there's so much in there that you play with in this book. I mean, among them, this idea that readers of fiction still hunger to know what is fact and
I mean,
truth.
It's a strange thing, and it's true of me as a reader. You're reading a novel, and there's a female character in the novel, a main character, and she's described as having, a head of blonde curls, and then you look at the author photo and you see the right. author has a head of blonde curls, and you can't help thinking, like, is this based on her life? How much of this is true? There's always that level. There's a game that's implicitly played between author and reader always, I think. And it's not even a conscious game, I think, a lot of the time, over just how much of this is true. It's something I actually dealt with in my book Wonder Boys, too. So part of what I was trying to do here was just make that game explicit, but also, you know, to try to get at this idea of this is what happens in families, all families, is that something, the stories emerge, but whether those stories are the truth or not is far from clear.
Well, you hear the Benny Goodman coming back, which means we just have seconds left, but I have to ask you this. Will you ever write a memoir based solely on the facts of your life?
Well, if I do, I probably won't tell anyone that's what it is.
Okay. Michael Chabon is the author of several books, including The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay, for which he won the Pulitzer Prize. His new novel is Moonglow. He'll be at a Brookline Booksmith event at the Coolidge Corner Theater tonight, and you can find a lot more information at radioboston.org. Michael Chabon, such a pleasure. Thank you for the book, and thank you for coming.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. Thank you.
And that's it for today. I'm Anthony Brooks. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.